Genesis 48. It has been said many times, and it's true, that you're not ready to live effectively until you're ready to die. That's not a morbid statement, it's actually the truth. One of the reasons that often people waste their youth, and we won't have a show of hands, but it happens a lot, is because when you're young, you feel bulletproof and you have an inadequate grasp of mortality. As you get older, that grasp becomes firmer, or should. And when you reach some form of genuine maturity at whatever point in your life, you should be able to grasp the concept of dying, and you should have a theology big enough to handle it. And that means you need to know the Lord. You should have the ability to know the certain knowledge that every novel has a beginning and an ending, that every life is worthy of a novel itself, and that someday someone's going to write the epilogue to your novel. There will be a final chapter for you, and you should live toward that chapter. Again, I'm not being morbid. This isn't something that that we just want to skate over. This is actually sober and not exactly unjoyful for people who know God. People who don't understand about death, people who refuse to go to church because it reminds them of death, or refuse to go to hospitals because they're afraid of dying, or refuse to go to memorial services, or refuse to go to funerals, are living sadly. It is much more realistic, as the writer of Ecclesiastes, Solomon, said. It's the house of mourning is actually better than the house of feasting. You live sadly if you're not able to embrace the idea that life will come to an end and you're not able to live in that direction. If you're running away all the time, stopping your ears and saying, well, I just don't want to think about that. In the long run, it'll catch up to you, and you will live a panicked kind of a life. You'll constantly be worrying about having to think about the end of your life. As Christians and as covenant people throughout history, whether old or new covenant, people who've known the Lord have actually looked forward to dying. I don't mean they don't live effectively here. I don't mean they don't live joyfully here. And I don't mean they speak of death every single day. But I do mean that they realize that the end of their life is actually a good thing, the end of their life here, because of the beginning of life with the Lord. And it's one of the few places, when you come to church with real Christians, with real covenant people, it's one of the few places where you can speak realistically and joyfully about death without just pretending and being in denial. And if you've ever heard people talk about death who don't know the Lord, you know how kind of empty the culture is on the subject. There's a lot of emptiness and a lot of shallowness. We come into chapters 48 to 50 of Genesis, and it's the end of Genesis. And it's the end of Jacob, and it's the end of Joseph. It's the last chapters for both of their lives. The writer of Genesis, Moses, draws both of their stories to a close, which is interesting because Joseph, of course, being Jacob's son, you could stretch his story out a lot longer, but the writer of Genesis doesn't do that. He actually, in these last three chapters, brings both of these stories to an end. And we see, in beginning in the end of chapter 47, going into chapter 48, we see how Jacob was preparing to die, what his preparations were, and they were very realistic preparations, and he knew he was ready. He was about 147 years old. I think that's pretty close to being ready, although his dad and his granddad lived quite a bit longer than that. And he was saying, it's very close to time for me to go. He doesn't seem to be weeping about that. He doesn't seem like he's all worried about it. And the reason is because he knows God. And he looks back on his life, and he sees the ups and the downs, and he says, I've known the Lord, and I'm a man who has a covenant with God. And you can face death effectively that way. And then we read the end of Joseph's life as well, although we don't see all of his preparations. But we do see the end of his life in chapter 50. So we're going to pick up in chapter 47, in verse 27, What has happened up to this point is that Jacob, with about 170 family members and plus a few other folks, has moved down from Canaan in the midst of the famine, where they had to leave their homeland, the promised land, which, by the way, they didn't actually own exactly. They lived up there, but they didn't exactly own it all. And they moved down to Egypt, where God had planned all along, if you remember from last time and the time before, God had planned all along to use Egypt as sort of an incubator for his nation, that they might grow in safety and some isolation in Egypt into a huge number by the time Moses came along. So the Lord has brought this family down. He set it all up. Joseph, the son of Jacob, had been made the prime minister, and you know the whole story. Now they've moved down there, and they are overjoyed to have food. They're overjoyed not to have to worry. They sort of miss the hills, because there are very few hills in Goshen, but down on the Egyptian plateau. But other than that, they're happy to be in Egypt. And they will stay there for some 400 years. It will not be happy by the time they leave, but that's yet far in the future. Right now, they're very relieved to be there, and God is using this in their lives. And so what happens is that in the narration, beginning in verse 27, it now moves quickly toward the end of Israel's life, or Jacob's life. Now, Israel lived in the land of Egypt, in Goshen, and they acquired property in it and were fruitful and became very numerous. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. They did indeed become very numerous. As you know, they were up over 1 million by the time Moses led them out of Egypt. And they grew at about 5 to 6% per year, which is a phenomenal growth when you start multiplying it out. The Lord said, be fruitful and multiply. They took that seriously. They were fruitful and they multiplied. And that was what frightened the Egyptians. Finally, they outnumbered them eventually. Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years after he moved there, and the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph. He said, please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. It's odd to put your hand under someone's thigh. You don't want to do that without asking them anyway, and in our culture, it would be rather weird. Nobody even, thinks about such a thing. But then again, we have some odd customs in our world that would seem strange to them as well. And this was something not uncommon, to make a solemn oath. You let him sit on your hand, and you promise. And I guess you just don't get to leave until you say yes. Maybe that's got something to do with it. I don't know. But that was what they did. And so he said, this is a solemn promise. Very serious, solemn promise. Do not bury me in Egypt. Now this is, it sounds like, well, okay, I've read that and it seems to make sense. But don't forget that in order to bury him up in Canaan, which is what he's insisting on, they're going to have to go 3 weeks one way with a dead body. So this is not a small thing he's asking. Plus, he's talking to the only people in the world who effectively embalmed people, which meant you could actually travel that distance at that time of history with a dead body, with a corpse. The only people in the world who could do that without, really smelling bad all the way up there were the Egyptians. It's very interesting that he knew he could ask this of Joseph in the place he was. This would not ever be asked by anybody in those days, really, because they would have to bury people. And when Rachel died, she was buried in Ephratah, which is Bethlehem, because they needed to bury you within a very short period of time. The Hebrews didn't embalm people. Most people didn't in those days. The Egyptians had it down to a science, and they could keep you for a while. And so it's interesting that he should say this, and he must have thought about it. He must have thought about it. He must have been thinking about it when he went down there. He thought, if we go down there and we stay there, I'm going to die there. He must have thought to himself, I'm not dying and being buried in the promised land. What am I going to do? And he mulled it over and mulled it over, and he heard about the Egyptians embalming their noblemen, which they did do. And he thought to himself, well, my son, the president, he could do this for me. So he calls him in and he says, don't bury me here. It's much more than just saying, don't bury me here, like we would say. You don't just fly his corpse up to another place. He's actually asking probably the only guy in the world who could grant this to a Canaanite and carry his bones, his mummified body, 3 weeks up into Canaan and have a funeral. So it's an interesting thing. And the reason he asks it is because he trusts that God is going to bring Israel back into the land, something that perhaps other people did not believe, but Jacob believed it. He believed it. God said, I'm giving you this land, and he's going to tell this story in a minute to his grandsons, but he says, I trust that God's going to do that, and I want to be part of that promise, and you are not leaving my bones here. And Joseph, interestingly, when he grants this request, when it comes time for him to graduate, he says the same thing to his brothers, and he says, you pass it down, and he died, you know, 350 years before they finally left. And he said, you make a promise too. You're not leaving me here. You're not leaving my bones here. So he learned something from Dad about trusting God in the covenant and being back up there in the promised land. So that's what he says. You got to, don't bury me in Egypt. When I lie down with my fathers, you're going to carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place, he said. And he said, I will do as you have said, Joseph promises. Swear it to me, says Jacob. You're not getting your hand out of here, pal, till you tell me that this is going to be so. So he swore to him. Then Israel bowed in worship at the head of the bed. Can be translated on the staff, too, either way. Now, it came about after these things. We don't know how much after these things, because Jacob figured he was going to die soon. Probably wasn't too much longer after this. Some commentators think maybe the other sons were starting to filter in, even as Joseph and his two boys arrive. But what happens in chapter 48 is this really old guy, Jacob, after years of worshiping God, serving God, and all of his mistakes and all of his ups and downs, he's there on the edge of his bed, and he's speaking to his grandsons and to his sons. Chapters 48 and 49. Starts with his two of his grandsons, chapter 48, and moves on into chapter 49. The scene is either in his tent or in some sort of building in which he lived. And he knows he's going to go be with the Lord soon. Incidentally, they didn't call it going to be with the Lord. They called it going to be with their fathers, which is an interesting way to put it. It came about after these things. Joseph was told, behold, your father is sick, meaning this is very close to the end. So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Now, these are the two boys that were born to him in Egypt. And they're half Egyptian, because remember, Joseph's wife was Egyptian. Okay, so these two boys are half Egyptian, and they look for all the world like Egyptian noblemen, very different than the Canaanite look, remember. And so he brings his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And it was told to Jacob, behold, your son Joseph has come to you. And Israel collected his strength and sat up in his bed. He was happy that they had come, and he kind of gathered what little strength he had, and he kind of leans up and he wants to talk to him. Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. Now, this is Bethel. He called it Luz, but this is what later became Bethel. And this was the initial experience that he had. Now, he's thinking back some 70 years. He's thinking back. Most of us in this room, as I look around at folks' faces, most of us will not remember back 70 years because we weren't here 70 years ago. And some who were here 70 years ago don't remember the day all that well from 70 years ago. He's 147, thinking back to only about half of his lifespan. 70 years. And that was when the Lord spoke to him. Remember when he was escaping from his brother? And he was on his way up to Paddan Aram, where he would meet his beloved Rachel and the other women who were not so beloved? You remember that? And on his way, he's thinking, I've left everything behind. And God meets him at Bethel and says, yes, you may have left. And he had, of course. He escaped barely with his life. And God said, yeah, you've escaped with your life, but you belong to me. And you know, that defined Jacob, even though he made mistakes, and even though he was something of a conniver, and even though, you know, we know lots about Jacob and his shortcomings. But it defined his life from that day forward. Now, here he is at the end of his life, and he's speaking to his son, and he looks back and he says, I may be an old guy and I don't see all that well, but I remember when God spoke to me, and it defined me. From that day on, I knew I had a covenant with God. I knew I belonged to Him. And he's been faithful to me, and he's the God of my fathers. And so here he's at the end of his life, and you know what he wants to talk about? All the land that he had? No. All the stuff that he inherited from Uncle Laban? No. The fact that he had all the sons and all the he was a very wealthy, powerful man as a clansman up there? No, none of that stuff. Let me tell you. Let me remind you, I have not forgotten. The shaping force of my life is my relationship with God. My identity in him, that is what has always mattered. More than anything else, more than all my dysfunctional homes and dysfunctional kids and violence in my background. And he had all of that and more multiplied times 12. You think you have kids that have trouble. When was the last time one of your kids ran out and slaughtered an entire town? Okay? So he had some dysfunctional kids. And he says, you know what? It doesn't matter. I belong to God, and I know I do. So here he is at the end of his life, and what matters to him most is Bethel. Bethel. Where God said, you belong to me, and I am going to take care of you, and you're going to be part of me. You're going to be part of my plan. You know, I tell you, when you get to the end of your life, and you sit on the edge of your bed, and you tell your story to your kids and your grandkids, I hope you look back on something like Bethel, where you say, I have belonged to God. I have had these problems, and I've had these difficulties, and these dysfunctions, and these hassles. And you know what? I'm ready. I'm ready to go. I'm old. I'm tired. I'm ready to go. But let me tell you, the defining moment in my life was when I gave my life to the Lord. That should be the way we do it. I hope that that is the way you'll do it. So he says to Joseph, it was at Luz, it was at Bethel. And he blessed me. And he said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous. And of course, that came true. And I will make you a company of peoples. At the time, he was a lone guy with no wife and barely the clothing on his back, and he had to use a rock for a pillow that night when God spoke to him. God says, I'm going to bless you. You're going to become a whole nation. And of course, now he was, as he relates the story. He says, I'm going to give you the land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. That same land that he went to sleep on that night. And now, your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Now what he does is he comes right back to Joseph and he says, I'm adopting your two boys. God promised me that I would have a great clan that would be my nation. And it was happening right then. Now he says to his son Joseph, must have surprised Joseph. He says, I'm adopting your two boys. The ones that were born to you in Egypt. They are now mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine. Notice he puts Ephraim's name first, even though Manasseh was the oldest. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are. I am going to elevate these two grandsons of mine to the status. These kids are only 20 years old, these young grandsons. They're only 20 years old, but he's going to elevate them to the status of patriarch on the same level as Reuben and Simeon. He says, I'm adopting them as of now. It's interesting, that's all he had to say. He was the patriarch. There was no paperwork to do. He simply said, this is it. Boom. And it was. From that day forward, these two young men were considered his own sons. Now, your offspring that have been born after them can be yours. Thanks, Dad. And they'll be called by the names of their brothers and their inheritance. Now, as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died to my sorrow. Oh, so many years ago, and he still misses her. To my sorrow, Rachel died. Rachel was the one, of the four women that bore all of his sons, Rachel was the one that he would have only been married to. That was his choice. She was the one, would have been the only one. The other ones were, in a sense, forced on him. And together, of course, God's plan was that he should have 12 sons and probably would have worn one wife out. So he needed more. But Jacob loved Rachel so much, and he didn't forget. It's interesting the things that come back into his mind. Bethel and Rachel. To my sorrow, in the land of Canaan on the journey, when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, who are these? You know, you can imagine the grandfather. He's not seeing all that well. And these strapping young Egyptian men walk in. And he goes, who are these? Well, he knows who they are. But, you know, any grandparent, they'd say, you know, now I am one, so I know these things. See, they say this kind of stuff. Well, who's this? You know who it is. You just say, who's this? Because it's kids. It's your own kids. It's your grandkids. You say, well, who's this? Who's here? Who are these? Joseph said to his father, these are my sons, whom God has given me. He's probably thinking, and whom you have taken. Thank you. He said, bring them to me, that I may bless them. Now, they're going to get a patriarchal blessing just like the other boys, or boys, you know, they're in their 60s and 70s, you know, but these two young men are going to get a blessing from Jacob. Now, the eyes of Israel were so dim from age that he could not see, and Joseph brought them close to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your children as well. You can just see this old man thinking, this was an utterly unexpected blessing that I never, never asked for, didn't know that God would give me. And here it is. I thought I would never see you again. And who would have ever known I would actually see your sons? Wow. And Joseph took them from his knees and bowed with his face to the ground. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left, Manasseh with his left hand towards Israel's right, and he brought them close. Now, get the picture. Here's old Israel, and he's sitting there, and he's going to stretch out his hands. He's going to put his hands on these two young men, and he's going to actually do a prophetic blessing, an extremely important thing. And so Joseph takes his two boys, and he sets up Manasseh on Joseph's left, so he'll be on Israel's right. You got it? So he'll get the blessing of the firstborn. And he sets up Ephraim on his right, so he'll be at Israel's left, and he'll get the other half of the blessing, or what's left over. And that's the way it's set up. The firstborn is supposed to get, you know, and Manasseh was the firstborn, and Manasseh's thinking, that's the way it's done. I'm going to get this blessing. And so he sets it up. It's why it's said this way. It's not just meaningless highlights here. This is part of the account. This is very important. Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the hand of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, crossing his hands, although Manasseh was the firstborn. And then he blessed Joseph as he blessed the boys. He's actually blessing Joseph, okay? Now, Joseph's probably got his eyes closed or something. He's not watching what's going on. But the old man, as the boys come forward, the old man who cannot see very well, figures what's going on, because he can hear what's going on. Okay, Manasseh, you're over. Ephraim, you're right here. No, okay, yeah. Okay, now you just stand right there. And Grandpa's going to put his hands on your head. Okay, so you stay right there. And Grandpa knows which one's which. And he just changes his hands over, like that. And he goes ahead and blesses him. The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked. What a history. The God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day. The angel who has redeemed me from all evil, from all harm is the idea. Bless these lads, these boys, and may my name live on in them. Can you imagine being a 20-year-old young man having this aged man? He is seven times older than they are. Let's translate that into, let's pretend he's seven times taller. Okay? He's seven times older. His life is huge. His history is huge. His life experience with God, these two 20-year-old men are, you know, they're saplings under this huge oak tree. And he reaches out and he touches. Imagine being one of those young men. And you're hearing him say these things. What an impact would that. You know, if you don't grasp that, then you should. You should understand the generational work that is done when faith is passed on from generation to generation. And here's this man who's an oak tree. And he's saying, you young saplings, my name will continue in you. This was an awesome scene, lost on our culture that doesn't see the value of older generations and does not connect with their life history. Lost on our culture, but not lost on these people. This is an awesome thing. And the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac. These two young Egyptian boys who didn't even know their grandfather, really. Maybe they got to know him in the previous few years, but now they are inheriting something Abraham and Isaac had. And I wonder what the realization was in their souls. And may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now Joseph apparently at this point opens his eyes or whatever. He becomes aware that his dad crossed his hands. Joseph said to his father that had laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, and it displeased him. He saw that, and it displeased him. And he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to his father, "Not so, father. This one over here is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head. You can just see him. Here's the old guy, and he's finished his blessing, you know?" And Joseph opens up his eyes, and he sees, oh, my goodness, he's touching the wrong guy. And he reaches out, and he grabs, you know, Jacob's, and here's Joseph looking like an Egyptian. Did they all look like Yul Brynner, do you think? He's the guy I always think about. Here's Joseph, and he's you know, young, strong, and he's taking his old father, "Hey, leave my hand alone." Here's the old guy, he's going, "No." Now, he says, "You're making a mistake." And Jacob says, "No, I'm not. Not so, father. This is the one." His father refused. Verse 19 says, "I know, my son, I know. And he also shall become a great people and also shall be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." And he blessed him that day, saying, "By you Israel shall pronounce blessing, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh." In other words, eventually, there was a proverb in Israel that if you are really blessed by God, you're blessed like Ephraim and Manasseh. That's how blessed they were. It became proverbial among Israel. Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh, which is why to this day, even in scholarly circles, you always say the names of these two men, the youngest one first. Very unusual. It should be the oldest one first. But it's because of this. And then in verses 21 to 22, he says, I'm about to die. God will be with you to bring you back into the land of your fathers. And I give you one portion more than your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite by my sword and my bow. So he's giving them some land. We'll see more about that in the future. Does this remind you of anything in Jacob's life? Do you remember how Jacob tricked his father Isaac when he was aged and he couldn't see, and Jacob impersonated Esau, and Jacob was the younger one who got the birthright? And here now, he's not being tricked. He's actually doing what apparently God had told him to do, because all of this stuff is prophetic. And as he moves on into the next chapter, and all of his other sons now are starting to gather around him, and they are all standing around him in this next chapter, and he's blessing each one and prophesying over them. The Lord apparently said, "Hey, just like it was with you and your brother, I'm not doing it the way it's normally done among human beings. I'm not taking the firstborn. I'm taking the secondborn. And you won't have to be tricked in order to make it work." Remember we talked about Isaac, you know, kind of not wanting to go along with the program, even though God had told him ahead of time, it's the way it's supposed to be, and Isaac didn't want to do it. So some trickery occurred and so on. Well, here Jacob is thinking to himself, imagine him thinking these things. "I remember my dad doing this very same thing, and he had to be tricked in order to bless the secondborn over the first. I'm not going to make that mistake. I'm going to cross my hands right now. I'm going to do exactly what the Lord tells me to do." Joseph thinks it's a mistake. Jacob knows he's doing the right thing. So how many things that you plan don't go the way you planned them? "Lord, it's always done this way. This is the way it's supposed to be. This is the way it is. So what's the problem here?" And the Lord says, "Well, the problem is I'm in charge. And I've decided not to do it the way humans always do it." One of the recurring themes in the book of Genesis is that God blesses by covenant, not always by human custom. Not the way we plan it, not the way we think it ought to be. It's a recurring theme, these surprise things where we say, "Well, you ought to bless that guy." And God says, "I know you think that's the case, but I'm going to bless him." And there's this, or her, and there's this sovereignty where he says, "I'm in charge of where my covenant goes." And we say, "Well, oh." And I got to believe Joseph was probably thinking that. "Oh, okay, I guess, if that's the way it needs to be." Do you ever wonder if the Lord doesn't do stuff just to remind us who's in charge? from time to time, just to say, hey, gotcha. You know, we're cruising along thinking, yeah, we know, we're right in step. We know exactly what God's going to do. Evangelicals are famous for thinking they know what God's going to do next. They're famous for it. And they're also famous for being wrong. Because they make the kind of thinking that Joseph made. See, they do the kind of thinking Joseph said, no, it's not done that way. And God says, well, sometimes it is. And sometimes I do the unexpected. And sometimes I use people you wouldn't use. And sometimes I use people you think are not as useful as you are. And I decide to use them anyway. You're a firstborn. You know, if I'm Manasseh, I am a firstborn. See, so this is offensive. I think we need to have like a firstborn defense league or something here, you know. So you're a firstborn, and the Lord says, I'm deciding to use somebody besides you. And you say, well, it's not done that way. You have to use moi. And he says, no. In fact, I'm using your little brother, Neener Neener. And the little brother is probably going, yes. You know, and the older brother is thinking, Lord, you could use anybody in the whole world except my little brother, and it would feel better to me. Do you ever feel that way about what God does? Well, I don't know. I don't know what your situation is, but I know this. The Lord delights in using people we would not use. He delights in changing up the situations from what we would consider to be the right thing to do. And he delights in sometimes changing our cultural predispositions to things and simply saying, I've decided to do it this way. And that's what happens here. And so these two young men are blessed. And by the way, this is why you never hear about the tribe of Joseph. For those of you who study the Bible and you read through the lists, you don't hear about the tribe of Joseph. What you hear about is the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Manasseh. That's because Joseph was given two tribes instead of one. He was blessed doubly. And you also need to realize, and we'll see it in a moment, Reuben, the oldest, the firstborn of Jacob, who was close to 70 at these events, loses the right of the firstborn, and Jacob actually gets it back. And you can read about that, and we won't turn, but it's in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, and talks about it there. And what happened is, the Lord said, I'm doubling Joseph's portion. That's why when you see the lists of the 12 tribes of Israel, you don't find a tribe of Joseph. You find the tribe of Manasseh, and the tribe of Ephraim, and the rest of the guys, but not Joseph. Joseph is well represented, doubly represented, but it's under his two sons' names. Jacob summoned his sons and said, assemble yourselves that I may tell you what shall befall you in the days to come. He's moving the prophecy on now. Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob. Now from verse 2 to down to verse 27, it's all poetry in Hebrew. It is prophetic poetry. Do not underestimate prophetic poetry. Whenever something important had to be said to Israel of a prophetic nature, it was usually done in poetry. All the prophets are written in poetry. And it's an anointed way that they had of speaking. And it was under the anointing of the Spirit of God that he did this. This is legitimate prophecy. He's speaking about what's going to happen to these young men. Or actually, they're not such young men at this point. But he's speaking of what's going to happen in their tribes and the kind of personality their tribes are going to have. This is a very important moment. So he begins with Reuben. And well, we'll just work our way through and see what happens. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity, preeminent in power. Reuben's looking around. The guys are going, yeah, preeminent. That's a good word. And Reuben's going, yeah, I'm the firstborn. Yeah. Maybe Dad forgot about my affair with Bilhah. Remember the affair with Bilhah? Maybe Dad forgot about that so many years ago. Bilhah was one of Jacob's wives. And Reuben slipped into her tent while Jacob was out of town. And Jacob heard about it, and he didn't do very much at the time, and it's kind of odd. It's back in chapter 35. Didn't do much at the time, but he hadn't forgotten. So right at the moment where Reuben is thinking, yes, I'm the firstborn, I hear this preeminent stuff, I really like that, I'm going to get some good presents here. He says, you're uncontrolled as water. The Hebrew word means frothing, tempestuous, unable to be controlled. He had something about him that he could not control himself. Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed and you defiled it. He went up to my couch my bed. You can imagine this old man. He's not seeing that well. He knows where his sons are standing around him. And he says this about Reuben, and he starts to say it. And then he switches to the third person singular. He's speaking first person. You will not be preeminent because you did this. And then it's almost as if he still can't believe that his son did this. And he says it in this other way. He went up to my bed. He took my wife. You can feel that. You can feel what this old man is thinking and feeling. And he's saying the prophecy is that you will not make a contribution to the nation of Israel. And Reuben didn't. And the tribe of Reuben never did. Firstborn. And he didn't live up to the calling. Simeon and Levi are brothers. The next prophecy. Their swords are implements of violence. These are the two who destroyed Shechem because Dinah was raped there. Remember? Their sister. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. He's separating himself from these two. Because in their anger they slew men, in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger. It is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. See, God is not cruel. God is not capricious and meaninglessly vengeful. And this is outside the covenant that they did this thing. And Jacob says, the prophecy in their lives is that they will not be blessed. Cursed be their anger. I don't want to be around people like that. And by the way, neither do you. Do you know people who are perpetually angry, whose anger really is a curse? Get away from them if you can. Get away from them. And don't let their anger infect you. He says, I don't want to be a part of that. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. That's exactly what happened. Simeon was absorbed by Judah as a tribe. And Levi, how did Levi get dispersed throughout Israel? Now remember the story. They were the priests, and they were not allowed to own their own property. Individually they were, but they didn't have tribal property. And so this was fulfilled. Simeon was absorbed eventually by Judah, just became a part of the tribe of Judah. And the Levites eventually, and that's the tribe of Moses, who's writing this, by the way, he was a Levite, they actually became the priests. You say, well, wait a minute, the priests, that was a blessing that they should be priests. That's true. And you know why? It was because when Moses was on Mount Sinai, or came down from Mount Sinai, and there was the golden calf thing, which we're going to get into here in Exodus when we start studying it, you'll see it. Who stood with Moses against the idolatry? It was this tribe. So long, so many years after this prophecy, this tribe stood with Moses against the idolatry. And the Lord said, well, I will still disperse them, but I will disperse them and they will still be blessed. Now, I want you to grasp that concept for a moment. Here you have a real discipline against these people, a real discipline, a genuine thing. I'm going to disperse them. They did a bad thing, and I'm going to disperse them. And then later they say, the same tribes, I just get so excited about this, I'm sorry. I love this. Because the same tribe says, Lord, we want to stand with you. And he says, really? Okay, you will. I will still somehow fulfill the discipline, but I will also bless you. And the Levites, the Levitical priesthood, were mightily blessed by God. Now look at the grace and also the sternness with which God deals with sin and learn a lesson. It's not that he okays their sin. They still have to bear the scar. They were still dispersed throughout Israel. But he can take bad stuff we've done when we repent, and he can turn it into something good. And that's what he did. And that's a good lesson for us to remember. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Now, Judah gets the greatest blessing of all of them so far in this group. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. It means praise. Judah means praise. It's a play on words. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares to rouse him up? In other words, strength and courage. The scepter will not depart from Judah. That means he'll have rulers in his line. Nor will the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes. Now, Shiloh is the Hebrew rendering. If you read a New American Standard or a King James, it reads the word Shiloh there. If you're reading a new International, it says this: the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. and the obedience of the nations is his. That's the NIV of that verse. And you know why? Because Shiloh means the one to whom it belongs. That's what the Hebrew word means. And can be rendered either as a proper name, Shiloh, or it can be rendered the one to whom it belongs. Either way, it refers to Messiah. Okay? Either way, it refers to the Messiah. And all the stuff, any word Shiloh that you ever read comes from this verse. Shilohians. Okay? That every time you see the word Shiloh, it comes from the Bible and it comes from right here. And it's a messianic word. It's a word about Messiah. And that he would come from the tribe of Judah. David was from the tribe of Judah. Jesus, the Messiah, is called the Lion of the tribe of Judah. It's right out of this prophecy, and it's referred to in Revelation 5:5. He's called the Lion of the tribe of Judah. So Judah is mightily blessed. Let's move on. Verse 13, Zebulun will dwell by the sea. Verse 14, Issachar, a strong donkey. I don't know if I'd really like that particular thing, but he's referring to strength. Verse 16, Dan shall judge his people. Verse 19, Gad, as for Gad, raiders shall raid at him, he shall raid at their heels. These are very brief prophecies, and we don't have time to go through how, through Jewish history, the tribes actually fulfilled these things, these prophetic words. I don't have time to go through all of them, but they did. As for Asher, his food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Naphtali is a doe let loose, and he gives beautiful words. It's an interesting thing, Naphtali. Just a little reminder, you guys know the name Barak? Not Ehud Barak in Israel today. Two good biblical names, Ehud Barak. But the Barak in the Bible, who fought with Deborah as one of the judges of Israel. In Judges chapter 5, there's a beautiful song. One of the most beautiful pieces of Hebrew poetry ever written, and one of the very, very earliest. And it was written by a man from Naphtali, Barak. He and Deborah wrote it together. They co-authored that song. Very interesting. He will be swift, and he'll be good with words. It's interesting, because we don't know much about Naphtali, but we know that Barak was from Naphtali. Joseph, and this is, again, a beautiful, long prophecy for Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring, and its branches run over the wall. And he extends that all the way down to verse 26. Blessing upon blessing. Now notice, who got the blessings? Judah and Joseph got the two major, major blessings. In verse 27, Benjamin, the last one, a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey, and in the evening he divides the spoil. They were known as warriors, the Benjamites. Now let me just point out in these prophecies, we've gone over some of them pretty fast, I know. But let me point out, Judah and Joseph got the blessings. Now, except Joseph wasn't a tribe, he didn't have his own tribe. What were the tribes of Joseph? Ephraim and Manasseh. And of the two, which of the two was supposed to be more blessed? We read it in chapter 48. Which one? Ephraim. Did you know that as the monarchy took off, in Israel, so many hundreds of years after this, when the monarchy really started under Saul, who was, by the way, a Benjamite, a ravenous wolf. And then under David, under Judah, the scepter came, and David was from the line of Judah, and it stayed that way. After Solomon, there was a civil war, and after the civil war, what surfaced were two preeminent tribes, Ephraim and Judah. In the north, the northern 10 tribes were actually called Ephraim. If you read the prophets and you read the historical books, it interchanges the name Ephraim with Samaria. That means the north. When it talks about Ephraim, it's talking about the north. Why did they call the north Ephraim? Because of this prophecy. Ephraim became the most dominant force in the north. And Judah became the most dominant force in the south, and Jerusalem was the capital of Judah. And the name Jew comes from the word Judah. To this day, Judah stands as the preeminent tribe. The name Jew comes from about four different language groups that all trace their way back to Judah. So it came out exactly the way the Lord said it would. Verses 28 to 33, he says, I'm about to be gathered to my people, verse 29. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that's in the land of Ephron the Hittite. That's Machpelah, the cave of Machpelah, verse 30, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan. He says, I want to be buried up there. And he was, except no one can go there now and haven't been able to go there for years. And even when you could visit Hebron, I mean, you can if you want to take your life in your hands. It's in the disputed territories. Hebron is a very violent place right now. But even if you can get there, the Arab folks that live there won't allow you to go into the cave of Machpelah. So no one's been able to go down there and see the tombs. But there's one of them that looks Egyptian. It's Jacob. He said, bury me there. Chapter 50, they did exactly that. Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. He died right after he said these things, pulled his feet in to his bed, rolled over, and graduated right there. He had made his last prophecy, and Joseph is weeping over him. He commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. Now, 40 days were required for it. It took 40 days to do it, and such a period was required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. The Egyptians. They're weeping for him. They embalm him, and they give him this humongous funeral. And then verses 4 down to verse 11, they all went up to Canaan to bury him. And he goes back through the instructions. They take him all up there. Joseph went up to bury his father, verse 7, and with him went all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and the elders of the land of Egypt. He had gone to Pharaoh. He said, look, my dad died. I want to have a nice big funeral for him. Oh, you go right ahead, son. You do that. Take anything you need. So he takes this huge entourage of Egyptians. They travel up into Canaan, where they stick out like a sore thumb, and they have a humongous funeral up there. All the household of Joseph and the brothers in his father's household, they left only their little ones there with child care, and the flocks and the herds and in the land of Goshen. All the men, all the grown-ups went up there. And there went with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company, verse 9. Verse 10, came about to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan. And they lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentation, and he observed 7 days of mourning for his father. It took him 3 weeks to get up there, took him up there as a mummy, basically. And the Egyptians then set up camp, and they mourned for 7 days. And the inhabitants of the land of the Canaanites saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, and they said, this is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians. Wow! And that's why it's called that really unpronounceable name, beyond the Jordan. So even the native folks up there are going, can you believe this? Have you seen the Egyptians? They've been up here for a week, wailing every day. They're having this, I wonder who died. What Egyptian died? It wasn't an Egyptian. It was the only Hebrew, Canaanite Hebrew, mummified like an Egyptian and taken up there and buried. And thus his sons did for him as he had charged them. And his sons carried him to the land of Canaan, buried him in the cave in the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham had bought along with the field for burial from Ephron the Hittite. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers. Now verses 15 to 21 we already looked at when we were talking about his reunion with his brothers. But basically it's this. They came back and they said, okay, now dad's gone and we're afraid that he's the only reason that the brother who's in charge of everything now, Joseph, he's the only reason that Joseph hasn't killed us. So they come back and they said, they fabricate something from his will that wasn't really there. And they said, verse 17, you know, when before dad died, he told us to tell you to forgive us. Please forgive, I beg. That's what he, you know. Now, Joseph, this is what dad said before he died. Please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. Please forgive the transgression of the servants of God, of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. You know why he wept? Because he probably knew they were lying. But he read through the truth, and that is that they knew what they had done was so wrong so many years ago. And it broke his heart. And there was real reunion after that among them. And he says basically it's okay. The classic verse is verse 20. You meant it for evil against me. God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. It's So don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them, and he spoke kindly to them. What an interesting scene at the very end of it all. Well, verses 22 to 26, Joseph lives another 55 to 60 years in between verses 21 and 22. He saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons, verse 23, and the sons of Machir, and he lists, you know, who he saw. And then he said, now I'm about to die. Now look at the faith that he has, same as Jacob. God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. So Joseph died at the age of 110 and was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. And there he stayed for 350 more years, or roughly that amount, until Moses came along, and we'll see that in Exodus. And when Moses took the people of Israel out of Egypt, they had an Egyptian mummy with them. It was Joseph. And they took him all the way up there. And you know something else? They drug the poor guy all around for 40 years in the wilderness too. Before they finally got in, and Joshua finally tells us in chapter 24 that he had Joseph finally buried up at Shechem, which is exactly where Jacob had said his land would be, up at Shechem. So he gets, finally, he rests in Canaan, you know, 500 years later, something like that. Isn't that amazing? Now, let me ask you this. You guys know Hebrews 11, verses 21, 20 and 21? Hebrews 11, 20 and 21 quotes this entire section in two verses. And it says, by faith Jacob blessed his sons, leaning on his staff, which we just saw. By faith Joseph refused to allow his bones to stay in Egypt and said, you're going to take me with you, because God's going to bless you. You don't leave my bones here. You take me with you. Why would the writer of Hebrews, and we're going to close with this, why would the writer of Hebrews pick out these two things right here at the end of Genesis in his list of how to live by faith in Hebrews 11? It's because of this. These men had unfulfilled promises in their lives, things that had yet to be done. The writer of Hebrews picks that up and he says, look how they lived in faith when it all hadn't been done yet. Look how they continued to trust God when it looked like they were going to stay here forever. But they said, we're not staying here forever. I don't know how long we'll stay. They didn't know exactly how long. But he says, we're not staying here forever. And when we go, you're taking us with you. That's why Jacob and Joseph, at the end of their lives, are brought out. That story is brought out in Hebrews. Because the lesson is that a person who really lives by faith always has unanswered prayers. A person who lives by faith always has unanswered prayers. I don't mean that God's not listening. I mean he still has a bunch of stuff yet to do and you're hoping he does it soon and he hasn't done it yet. That's what I mean. So if you're in that space, you've learned a lot from Genesis. To live by faith means you're trusting God when he hasn't really come through yet, but you know he will. And you keep saying, I know the Lord will be faithful to me in the future. I feel kind of bad right now, and I haven't seen the fulfillment of it all yet. But these two deaths, actually, and the what's on the lips of these men, actually is the reminder to us that God is faithful no matter what. No matter what. From the beginning of Genesis all the way to the end, it is about God's faithfulness. So if you've got unanswered prayers, you've got stuff you're trusting God for, and you don't know where it's going to come from yet, and you don't know how God's going to answer you, but you're going to have to keep going by faith in the direction he's given you, congratulations. That's what it's all about. That is what it's all about, and that's what every generation has done who's ever walked with God. Let's bow our heads. Father, as we look at the end of Genesis, and the end of Jacob's life, and the end of Joseph's life, we are reminded, Lord, when we look at our unanswered prayers, when we look at the things that we think should be coming that have not yet come, we are reminded that we're living exactly the way they did. Though we live so long after them, you are the same, and the hearts of human beings are very much the same. And we live in this new covenant rather than the old one. But your faithfulness is the same. So teach us from these things, Lord, as we lay before you right now the things for which we are trusting you in the future. Maybe it's a job. Maybe it's physical health to face the challenges. Maybe it's enough money to survive throughout the next year. Maybe it's something to do with a marriage or a child or a grandparent. Lord, whatever it is, I pray that every person hearing my words right now would be able to say, I trust you, based on your faithfulness to Jacob and your faithfulness to Joseph. Because, Lord, it's easy for us to read stories, we know. It's hard for us to live life when there are many things that have yet to be done in our lives. Thank you for your faithfulness, Lord. Thank you that our home is actually not here either, and that we will be with you, not dead, but alive forevermore. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen.